Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. This is our Friday weekend podcast, and the episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. And we're trying to get our heads around all the things that are going on. We have the transcripts that are coming out. It feels like every hour there's another transcript, and they are truly amazing. The Roger Stone trial actually not only lives up to its hype, I think it's actually exceeded its hype. We have Jeff Sessions announcing for the United States Senate, his old Senate seat. And he put out a video that I'm gonna play it for you, and then ask the question: what is this culture of self-humiliation among all of these Republicans who, in general or in theory, celebrate machismo and being strong and fighting, and yet they spend so much of their life on their knees today? And of course, who else to talk to about all of this stuff other than Molly Jong Fast, who's in our studio. So happy Friday.
Thanks for having me.
I am fascinated to hear about your day. But I want to tell you about my day first.
Okay, tell me.
I've been off the grid for a while. I am now back in Wisconsin. You are in Washington, D.C. So I'm in my native element. You're sort of out of your native element. But I was in Little Rock, Arkansas this morning. And so have you ever been to Little Rock?
No.
Okay. So the first disorienting thing, and I couldn't talk to anybody in Arkansas about it because, of course, they're used to it. You land at the airport and you come out of the gate, and there's this gigantic mural picture of Bill and Hillary Clinton because it is the Bill and Hillary Clinton airport. Did you know? Okay, that was my reaction. The Bill and Hillary Clinton airport. So you're sitting there, you know, reading Twitter or whatever and hearing the announcements, you know, welcome to the Bill and Hillary Clinton Airport. If you want to access our free Wi-Fi, you just go to blah, 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 blah at the Bill and Hillary Clinton Airport. It's just odd. And so I spoke to a very, very nice group, and I said I like to pride myself in thinking that Wisconsin politics is the most interesting state politics in the country. But then, of course, it's Arkansas. And Arkansas has not only given us Bill Clinton, it's also given us Mike Huckabee, and they might be about to have Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So I have questions about that. So anyway, so that was my experience. I was fascinated and am fascinated by Arkansas. You know, Arkansas is a state that used to have Democrats.
Bill Clinton.
Well, they used to have the Yellow Dog Democrats.
Right.
And they were a very different kind of Democrat. And the politics was different. And they're all gone. It's an amazing phenomenon when you go to these states where the Democrats used to dominate the offices, and now they are just wiped out.
Yeah, except the Democrats have now states they never had before. It's the topography has totally shifted. Like Arizona and New Mexico.
Well, we gotta hold on to them. You have to do all this. Okay, so I want to do this. You spent the day at the Roger Stone trial?
So actually, even more weird than that. So first we went over to the Roger Stone trial, which was, you know, I went into the press room. I heard Randy Credico read out insane emails that he had with Roger Stone, where Roger Stone threatened him continuously and Roger Stone called him names. And there was a lot of cursing. So Randy kept saying, well, what do I say for the curse words? And so that was fun. And, you know, the judges, it's like, you know, these judges are very serious. So they, you know, first the judge said, don't do this or that, you know, all the various and sundry things. But I guess she's like very happy because Roger is behaving much better than he has in previous.
He's not having a good trial so far, is he?
Right.
I mean, he really isn't.
As far as
I can tell, it was a pretty bad day. Steve Bannon testified, and apparently,
exactly.
Steve Bannon was interesting. And the prosecutor had to when Bannon tried to do a little bit of dancing and shuffling, had to read back his sworn testimony before the grand jury, the kind of experience that would tend to focus your mind. So, did you see Bannon at all?
I didn't see Bannon, but I did see that Bannon said that the point of contact between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign was Roger Stone,
and
which is pretty devastating.
And they talked a lot.
Yeah. I mean, and with the Randy Credico stuff, he had lunch with Julian Assange twice and was connected to Stone. So it makes sense. I mean, the larger question, of course, with all of this is, so everyone is getting in trouble who did this except the president?
Well, what's fascinating, I was reading a tweet like 5 minutes before we started this podcast, looking at a tweet from our good friend Molly Hemingway, who is all Trump all the time,
right.
And was talking about using
her bad Molly.
Yes, to distinguish her from good Molly.
Yes, I'm good.
In our world, you are good Molly.
Right.
That may not be the universal opinion, but you are the good Molly. People should know this, that our shorthand is good Molly and bad Molly.
Compared to Molly Hemingway. Well,
she uses the phrase the Russia collusion hoax.
Right.
And I'm thinking, I suppose if you say that, if you say that incantation enough, then you ignore this evidence, first of all, the massive evidence that was in the Mueller report. But there you have the Roger Stone trial, prosecutors talking about Roger Stone in direct contact with the guy who was the source of the Russian hacking of the DNC, and Steve Bannon is there saying that Roger Stone was the contact person, and they talked about it all the time.
Yeah, it's really weird to me that we are having a trial for a crime that the president committed, but he can't be charged with because the president is above the law, which is what the Office of Legal Counsel said.
Well, even beyond that, it's remarkable that after all of this time, there is so much evidence of the Russian role in the election, that the Russians did attack, that should be beyond any question whatsoever. All of the intelligence agencies have said it. We know how they did it. We know what they did. We know the contacts they had with people like Roger Stone. And that's all in the shadow of the current Ukraine impeachment investigation, which largely turns on, and I think this tends to get ignored, largely turns on Donald Trump's attempt to basically push this wacko conspiracy theory that the Russians didn't do any of this stuff,
right,
that it was really the Ukrainians, which also is an attempt to discredit all of the intelligence agencies, rewrite history, and it is mind-boggling.
And the weirdest part, I think, of the whole thing is that this narrative, this Ukraine actually hacked the DNC narrative, is actually a Russian talking point. Like, it was created in Russia.
It's their talking point. Yeah, they are enjoying this. Okay, so you're going to write something about the Roger Stone case
for the Bulwark? Yeah.
Okay, so people have to do this. I have, as I mentioned to you before we started the podcast, they released several more transcripts, and I was only able to read them while I was on the plane. They really sound extraordinary. The Vindman testimony, mm-hmm. the Fiona Hill testimony, you can tell they are giving blunt and very, very graphic testimony. And it's getting closer and closer. Well, it is the Oval Office. I mean, let's not pretend there's any mystery here. There is no mystery here anymore. It's like people are waiting for, well, when are we going to get this piece or that piece? We have this. We have all of this. If John Bolton testifies, it's going to be dramatic. But when you have Colonel Vindman, when you have Fiona Hill, when you have Ambassador Taylor, Ambassador Volker, and their stories are remarkably consistent and detailed and graphic. So it is interesting. Have you noticed how the Republicans have sort of been sort of like flipping through cards of their defenses? I think they're sort of settling on, I mean, there's the no harm, no foul, which is like, since it didn't happen, which is a ridiculous standard because
I saw. Yeah. And then there's also the I didn't check today.
Yeah.
You know, I have a real job, so I can't just follow this. That was Tillis, I think.
Oh, the Tillis, yeah, Senator Tillis, he's going to have a year of humiliation. The other one is, but he was really too inept. Lindsey Graham, the day after, saying that he wasn't even going to look at the transcript. Lindsey's had a terrible week, but when did he not?
Well-deserved.
Yeah, I'm not even going to look at it. And then the next day it was, they were just too inept to actually do anything wrong, right? Then the story we have in the Washington Post today is House Republicans are thinking, maybe we just throw the deputies under the bus. Let's just throw people like Sondland and Giuliani under the bus. And then, of course, there's the I think, somewhat more serious defenses offered by people like Rich Lowry at National Review, which is that, look, it's just too divisive. It's too divisive to American politics to actually impeach the president, as if the president is not divisive or divisive, right, however we're going to pronounce it, on a daily, if not hourly, basis. But there is this flailing around.
That talking point to have the president of the United States, who is like the most divisive politician pretty much ever, to say that they can't impeach him because it would drive Americans apart seems really beyond ironic.
I would think so. And unfortunately, the word ironic's been kind of worn out. However, okay, good Molly.
Right.
Despite all of this, despite the mounting evidence of the president and clearly his getting closer and closer to various forms of meltdown, poll numbers relatively awful, this was the week when I think Democrats began to panic. And I think that panic centers on the fact that many of them are beginning to realize that Elizabeth Warren may not be electable. And we start with the horrifically bad reaction to her attempt to, you know, add up the numbers of how she's going to pay for her tens of trillions of dollars medical takeover and why she's going to ban private insurance and all that other good stuff, followed by the New York Times Siena poll, which showed that she would not beat Donald Trump in many of the, if any, of the six swing states that will determine who gets to 270 electoral votes. And then you had this other survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation that basically says that in these key states, places like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, some of the positions that she's holding are absolutely, absolutely toxic. And let me just pull this one up here. So, for example, in the swing state, voters oppose Medicare for All by a margin of 36 to 62. They oppose a ban on fracking 40 to 54. This is one of Elizabeth Warren's positions, and they reject decriminalizing illegal border crossings by a margin of 27 to 71%. So there's some real freak out among the Democrats in a week that we ought to be talking about the perhaps, you know, collapse of the Trump presidency. You guys are going to screw this up, aren't you?
Wait, is that a question?
No, it's an indictment. You were warned.
I think that there's, I don't know, you know, we're in this Democratic primary, and I have to believe, you know, I don't know, I was with a very smart journalist last night having dinner who's like very nonpartisan, and he was saying, if Democrats can't sell a populist economic message right now, then what can they sell? I mean, my personal opinion, not involved here, just for a second, Warren is able to sell this populist economic message. And right now, it may not, at this point in the primary, my personal feeling is that whoever wins the primary is going to be the person who has the best shot of winning the presidency. I mean, there is evidence to support that these large primaries do end up usually finding the most electable person as the person who wins it. Now, Trump.
Molly, hold on. Just hold on. Hey, could you get Rick Wilson on the line? Could you just call Rick? You have his
phone
number. Rick Wilson on line one.
All right. Well, disagree.
Tell Rick that we need an intervention here. Okay. Have you read Rick's new book, by the way?
Yes.
You have read it.
I don't agree with Rick Wilson. I like him a lot. He's one of my best friends in the world. I talked to him this morning.
He wrote this book for you.
I don't think he's necessarily right.
And what he's warning is that you guys, I'm sorry to keep saying you, that the Democrats are really at risk of blowing this because they need to understand who the voters are who are going to determine this election. And these voters are not buying what people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are selling. They are not going to go along with the idea of growing government by 50% and taking health insurance away from union households. That is not a winning message in Michigan.
Agreed.
Banning fracking.
Agreed.
On top of that, is not a winning message in Pennsylvania.
Right.
So it is possible that you will have voters who absolutely, utterly despise Donald Trump. And yet when they go into the voting booth, they'll say, who was it? I think it was it Schmidt who said this? Schmidt, who said that if it's a choice between a sociopath and a socialist, that voters are going to go with the sociopath.
Right. I mean, look.
Steve Schmidt.
It's possible. I do still think that we're still early in this. I still feel like we're early in this whole thing. And
you know what you sound like? You sound like the girl saying, "Yeah, but I just have to believe I'm going to get a unicorn for Christmas."
Well,
to believe.
I mean, I also think, look, Biden may still very much may win this thing. He right now is still the front runner, week after week. So, and I just don't know how it's going to play out. Well, I'm not.
Okay,
I mean, and
I mock you though.
I know.
No, 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 no. But I'm going to apologize for this now,
right?
Because you were a really early adopter of Mayor Pete.
Yes.
At a time when people, being me, could not pronounce his name. You were holding fundraisers for him, so you saw something.
Well,
and right now, Pete Buttigieg is the one who seems to be finding this centrist sweet spot. He seems to be thinking, they're talking about the exhausted American voters who just do not want more fighting, who want to imagine that day after Donald Trump leaves the presidency and all of these things. And he seems to be making this move into that lane. If Joe Biden falters, Mayor Pete is right there. So...
And look, if they can figure out a way, if that campaign can figure out a way to really speak to African-American voters, they could win this thing. But they have to, that is the Democratic base. And so they have to figure out a way to really appeal to those voters. And if they can, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I almost feel like Democrats have... What really went wrong with Hillary to a certain extent was that African Americans are like the lifeblood of the Democratic Party, and they need to, they are not just, you know, they're not just a get, like,
right,
they have, and yeah. I think that is the one thing that's really that's the issue for Pete. I love Pete. I think he's great. He's like a really smart and accomplished person, and he's really, I think he'd be a really great president.
You know, you are a very blunt, direct person.
Right.
Except what you were really saying there, and you were, again, you were, a little soft shoe in there. What you're really saying is Mayor Pete is gay, and African Americans might not vote for a gay white guy. Isn't that what you were saying?
Well, except I've read a lot of really smart African-American writers this week in the New York Times and the Washington Post who said, like, that's not true.
Okay, Jonathan Capehart has this very powerful, he's a black man and a gay man. It's time that I respond to a talking point making the rounds that African-Americans are homophobic and therefore won't vote for Pete Buttigieg, the openly gay and married mayor of South Bend. And he says it's just not true. Now, again...
Right.
I'm not an expert in all of this, but I do think you've identified the key point because there's
Charles Blow said that too. But I also think that the Buttigieg campaign has not been, Biden has really, really good African American surrogates. Like he had them early. You know, he went to those communities and said, like, this is what I'm going to do for you. Like, you can't, that they are. Like the backbone, they are why Democrats win elections. So to neglect that group is a mistake. And I also think my opinion's changed a little bit in the fact that I really like Kamala Harris. And I'm like very confused about the soul of America right now. And I don't know what exactly it looks like. And I also know that this election is only going to really take place in 6 states anyway, because it doesn't matter what happens in New York. York is going where it's going. It's going to be Wisconsin. We're just talking about this. Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania. So Wisconsin. So I don't know what's going to happen. But I do. So I don't know how misogynistic the culture is right now, and if people just won't vote for a woman, and that's what's happening.
Like, yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that that's it. And I think that the danger is that when there are substantive critiques of Elizabeth Warren about the substance of her policies, as well as the sort of style that she's got a big government plan for everything that ails us. If in fact the reflexive defense is this is sexist, I think that's a mistake. I think that's a way of putting your finger in. Okay, now I'm bringing up all of this stuff about the Elizabeth Warren panic to lead up to this question. So today, Democrats woke up to learn, you know, that something had happened that none of them had really asked for, which was Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City, is apparently entering into the president's race, because apparently we just don't have enough billionaires in American politics, and the Democratic field was just too small. I guess that must be the answer. But let's talk about this. So he clearly is entering this race because he is concerned about the rise of Elizabeth Warren. He doesn't like her progressive politics. He doesn't like her wealth tax. He clearly doesn't like the socialism of Bernie Sanders. And apparently he lacks confidence that the existing moderates in the race are going to be able to carry the ball. So it's an implicit critique of Joe Biden. So give me your take on Mayor Bloomberg and how that's going to play. How is Mike Bloomberg going to play in a Democratic primary?
Well, you know, my friend Harry Siegel from The Daily Beast, who's my editor, too, who I love, had this amazing tweet, which was like, say what you will about Dinkins, but at least he never ran for president.
Oh, I did like that. That was good.
Yeah.
He's the only New York mayor that hasn't looked in the mirror and went, I run New York.
Right, exactly.
If you can make it in the Bronx, you can make it everywhere.
That's right. I mean, that's the thing. I was surprised. I mean, I actually really like, just from my personal opinion, I really like Mayor Bloomberg. And I really liked him. I don't think the heart and soul of the Democratic Party is going to say, oh, look, this white billionaire who has all this money, this is where we want to be. It makes no sense. I mean, but what's interesting about him is people in New York are really, I don't know if you watched Morning Joe this morning, but Donny Deutsch was so excited. He was like, you know, that unfortunately that's not the Democratic base.
I was going to say the Donny Deutsch demographic is probably not representative of the Democratic electorate, but that's just me.
Right, exactly.
Spitballing here.
Other wealthy Jews, and I say this as myself, a Jew of, you know, that similar group, are really like him. But I think that to get the Democratic nomination, he's going to have to do a little more than that. The other problem, again, with him is that he did actually, you know, there's Obama trying to come for your guns, but Mayor Bloomberg really wants to come for your guns. You know, he's like set up all these nonprofits to actually come for your guns. So that is incredibly problematic. Also, I liked this in a mayor, but I don't know that I would love this in a president, is the soda tax.
I was going to wonder how you came down on the big soda tax.
Right. I mean, personally,
The
nanny state. I'm like, you know, largely a lot of my views are a little bit libertarian, so I think it's kind of insane to tax the soda, drink whatever they want.
You mentioned that it doesn't make any sense, him getting into the race at this particular point. I think it doesn't make any sense because it accomplishes absolutely nothing. In fact, I think a Bloomberg candidacy at this point is worse than useless, because it makes all the problems that he says he wants to solve, he makes them worse. For example, look, he's not going to win this nomination, but he is going to drain votes from the other centrist candidates.
Right.
He's going to cannibalize the support for Biden, Buttigieg, and people like Amy Klobuchar, maybe Cory Booker.
Do you think Amy Klobuchar is really in it at this point?
If you're hoping for a unicorn for Christmas, I can too. Okay, I'm in. Okay, so obviously
you get really really mad.
So this really helps Bernie and Warren. So the whole point is he's concerned that they're doing too well. So what he's done is pretty much, you know, he's helped them immensely. Also,
right.
The entry of just another billionaire, the guy's worth, what, $50 billion,
yeah,
is not exactly the right optics in a cycle where the Democrats are all focused on income equality and the unfair distribution of wealth. I mean, so making another billionaire the face of moderate or, you know, center-left Democratic politics is another huge boon for Bernie and Warren. So
I agree. I mean, I also think that's money that could be going to Democratic candidates. I mean, well, these are two of the largest Democratic donors are now like, well, I can do this too.
Well,
so you have
exactly. And this is again where you apparently, I don't know, Rick Wilson, you know, on line one, you know, his point is this: Bloomberg's money could actually, you know, make an enormous difference.
Enormous.
But not for by running for, you know, president himself. And he actually tweeted, he said, look, if you want to point a finger at two men with absolute certainty of guilt when Trump gets reelected, by Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, these are the two. He says, I cannot explain to you even a tenth of the resources would do to alter the battlefield in this campaign. And
no way.
And I think he's absolutely right about this. And he says, you know, if they really cared about defeating Trump, both of those men would be up on the effing air right now with a massive TV and digital campaign nuking the bleep out of him in the 15 swing states. I don't think there are 15 swing states. He says, but no, they have to, and he uses the more direct term, I would say, they have to pleasure themselves in public. And his book, which you need to reread, it's Running Against the Devil. Wilson talks about the danger of third party and vanity.
His book is really good.
It is excellent. And vanity candidates in an equation where the forces arrayed against Trump cannot afford to lose any votes. So the group these men fund on the outside currently will be put to their service. So this is that is the frustration, that if Tom Steyer and Bloomberg really wanted to take down Trump, there are a lot of things they could do, and they're doing the least effective thing possible almost.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, it's a lose-lose for all parties involved. I mean, we all hope that they'll just do the primary and then come to their senses.
Yeah.
But it's not that easy to tell a billionaire what to do.
Okay, I know you're not a psychologist or even play one on podcasts, but
I want
to play something for you, which I think is truly extraordinary, and then get your take on it. I don't know whether people have seen the hostage video that that Jeff Sessions has taped, his first ad of his new Senate campaign. I want to play that and then get your reaction. We're talking with Molly Jong Fast, but first a word from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only one in five homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Molly Jong Fast. All right, Jeff Sessions, who was humiliated and essentially kicked out of the position of attorney general, wants his old Senate seat back. And, of course, the biggest problem is that Donald Trump hates him, or at least, thought so little of him that he, you know, pounded him, pummeled him, insulted him for months before he unceremoniously kicked him out as attorney general for for a rare burst of independence when he never forgave Jeff Sessions for accusing himself from the Russia investigation. So everybody's wondering what's going to happen. Is Donald Trump going to tweet nasty things about Jeff Sessions and kill him in the Alabama Senate primary? Well, yesterday, Jeff Sessions, who has had a long and illustrious career in the United States Senate, has been the Attorney General of the United States of America, came out with his first ad. And this is his ad in its entirety.
Jeff Sessions here. I approved this ad when I left President Trump's cabinet. Did I write a tell-all book? No. Did I go on CNN and attack the president? Nope. Have I said a cross word about our president? Not one time. And I'll tell you why. First, that would be dishonorable. I was there to serve his agenda, not mine. Second, the president's doing a great job for America and Alabama, and he has my strong support.
Okay, Molly. That did look like a hostage video to me. So can you... I know it's almost old news at this point that people are willing to engage in self-humiliation, right? That's become a feature. But it's pretty amazing. These men who have been insulted and vilified and beaten up by Trump feel the need to embrace their abasement, right? What is this about?
I mean, I think it's all about Trump's Twitter and trying to win back. He knows he needs that base in Alabama, and he's trying to win them back. I mean, I think this is totally, like, Lindsey Graham, it's politically expedient.
Ted Cruz, these people, yeah, well.
These people all have no other choices. It's like when evangelicals vote for Trump and people are like, wow, you know, it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, they're saying, well, you know, he's this, he's that. He's the only choice. Well, he's the only game in town.
Maybe.
And I think,
here's another choice. How about some self-respect?
Right, but that's not a thing in American politics. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, no, there's never a moment where people go, oh, this is just too low for me. We've seen this over the last 1,000 days. There is no moment where Republicans go, this is just wrong. You know,
so self-respect is incompatible with political survival in the orange era?
In the era of Trumpism, yeah. 100%. And I also think that with Sessions, I mean, this is, as a Democrat, the greatest primary ever. Like, in my dreams, I cannot imagine Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, who is, like, endlessly problematic for his racism and also just one of the founding forefathers of Trumpism, because remember, he was one of his earliest supporters, versus Roy banned from malls Moore. I mean, you just can't get any better than this.
It will be good, but... I'm not disagreeing. It's just that I'm a little hung up on the total lack of any sort of self-respect, because the reality is that, you know, even you've had this moment where watching Bill Barr as Attorney General, you felt moments of sort of appreciation of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. The Jeff Sessions,
right,
for all of the things, all the problematic things you just mentioned,
right,
did apparently have limits, did have some,
right,
sense of the norms and constitutional proprieties, and he did have respect for the rule of law.
Right.
And so he looks better the farther we get into this bleep show of Bill Barr being Donald Trump's Roy Cohn. And yet, as opposed to going off into the sunset of his career with kind of, you know, an interesting story of personal integrity to tell, he puts that ad up, which just wipes it all away. It's an ad that is, you know, has an audience of one, and
right,
it's the wheedling and the please don't be mean to me type thing. I mean, when I'm in my 70s, I just do not want to be sucking up to anybody at this point. You know, I mean,
well, that's why you don't hold elected office,
and never will.
Yeah, I mean, I still think with Sessions, he's making a calculation,
yeah,
that there's a chance he knows Trump doesn't like Roy Moore. He knows Trump has already done Roy Moore, and Roy Moore lost. You know, he knows Trump doesn't like a loser. He knows that Alabama is a very red state. And I think he thinks that there's some calculus,
yeah,
in which Trump turns around, and the only way he's going to do it is if he's very sycophantic. and look.
Well, yeah.
It may work.
No. I get that's clearly what he's thinking. And that is the calc. And he may not be wrong. There is, however, the other alternative, which is, you know, I am Jeff Sessions. And you know that I will stand up to powerful people. You know that I am a man of my word. If you want, you know, and just basically run on your record and your integrity and your service, you know.
Wait, you want Jeff Sessions to run on his integrity?
Okay, you know what? I'm just.
I'm sorry. I'm the word.
Well, I'm not trying to give him advice, but I'm just saying that there were different life choices that he could make.
Right. But he probably would have made those before he was like the first Donald Trump surrogate.
Well, that's true, and that's worth remembering the role that he played.
Yeah.
In the rise of Donald Trump, cannot be overstated. It was a dramatic thing, and the way he changed the Republican position on immigration. Because I remember, for years. Our position was, as conservatives, that we were opposed to illegal immigration, but we were very pro-legal immigration.
That's
right. Immigrants made us richer. They made us better.
Mm-hmm.
We were much more inclusive. And that was the universal opinion of the Republican Party, with the exception of certain, you know, nativist restrictionists like Jeff Sessions, who was basically a caucus of one, saying that we have to restrict the legal immigrants. And he became more and more influential. And even Scott Walker from Wisconsin, when he was running for president, meets with Sessions, kisses up to him, begins talking about restricting legal immigration. And that was the beginning of what turned out to be kind of the tidal wave, the turnaround of Republicans into really being at least minimally comfortable with that kind of nativist, restrictivist policy and rhetoric.
And that's right. And I also, you have to remember that Jeff Sessions' office is what produced Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
Who is probably the worst thing to happen to America. I mean, we will be like, he'll be in textbooks as like the worst thing to ever happen to American politics.
Oh, I think it'll be than textbooks. I think he'll be a character in movies. I think he's going to be the Gollum of the miniseries they'll make about this.
He's written speeches that are responsible for people being murdered. I mean, he's written the explosive rhetoric that has set the dominoes in motion.
Well, I'm more hesitant to make those connections than perhaps.
But
you are.
I mean, as a Jew, as someone who's Jewish, you know, the largest mass murder of Jews ever happened a year and 3 days ago, ever on American soil, like. We survived the Holocaust in America, and there was never a mass murder of Jews. And then 1 year ago, there was a mass murder of Jews in a temple by a Trump supporter. And I mean, so you have to, I mean, there have been so many of those, you know, like Caesar Sozak, you know, he didn't kill anyone, but he was clearly motivated by this explosive rhetoric.
Well, so, and we are on the knife's edge. And the reality is that, you know, it's not completely theoretical. What does happen when the rhetoric becomes heated, when you demonize your opponents? Mm-hmm. We've seen this happen in other cultures. We've seen it happen in this culture. We saw it happen in the 60s and the 70s. This is why there is so much, why people who have bully pulpits should, you know, exercise great restraint and responsibility, because they don't know how people are going to respond. And there are, and I think one of the great things about social media is it has really exposed how many people are mentally unbalanced out there.
Right.
Seriously. I mean, there are people who are, you keep throwing the matches onto the fire. Who knows what's going to happen?
Right. No, it's scary. I mean, we have a culture of some really disenfranchised people who are, and you know, they're disenfranchised because the jobs that they should have gone away with automation. And so they need something, and Trump gave them that. But unfortunately, that is not a real thing. You know, Trumpism, I mean, I don't know if you saw, like, 2 nights ago, Trump had a rally after the Louisiana, after he helped Matt Bevin lose. Mm-hmm. He had another rally the next day, and people were just sort of wandering out because they're sort of bored of, you know, it's been 1,000 days of the same shtick.
You know, this is interesting that you mentioned that, because without violating any confidences, I was talking to somebody in Arkansas last night, And she was telling me about how she and she went to one of the Trump rallies. She's not a Trump fan, just to see it, and brought along her kids just to watch the phenomenon of it, out of curiosity. And she's standing next to some other man who had come and, you know, had stood in line and was at the Trump rally. And about an hour and 20 minutes into whatever the rant was that Trump was making, this man who she'd never met before turned to her and said, you know, I was curious, but I just can't do this. I just can't do this. And he walks out. You do wonder how many people who do show up at these just for the freak show. Because it is unusual when you see people filing out in the middle of it. So, the people who are there, you know, are liking the red meat and they're enjoying it. But that was a notable picture that people showed up and then they left.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth thinking about. I also think he gave people things to believe in a way that they didn't necessarily have. He gave them a sort of spirituality. It was this sort of, I think, kind of grotesque anti-spirituality, this sort of weird capitalist spirituality. I mean, I'm pro-capitalist. I'm not saying capitalist in a pejorative way, but, you know, he sold himself as this, like, great golden god with the golden toilets. And then and they sort of believed in him and loved his message and his voice.
It was entertaining, too.
Right.
You know? I mean, it was entertaining. I mean, it's, you know, people show up for the same reason they show up at a demolition derby, they show up at at mixed martial arts fighting. It's entertaining, and maybe there will be blood.
Right, it's true. I mean, it is, but it's interesting to me. I mean, I think a really interesting thing to think about, because I do think that Kentucky, him, you know, that was what happened in Kentucky is a big deal, I think, and it does further this idea that Trumpism cannot be transferred to other Republicans.
Yeah, I think that is the smart take. I mean, you can make the case, which, you know, is plausible, that the Bevin was so uniquely unpopular that the only way he even became competitive was by lashing himself to Donald Trump. But still, to lose in a state that Trump won by 30 points certainly does suggest that it's not transferable. Okay, this is a weekend podcast, so this is all too depressing. So, like, we want to talk about somebody that's not so apocalyptic. Let's talk about something. Let's talk about something fun. Let's talk about Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. Fun, but also problematic.
Okay, are you going to clutch your pearls over over Sean Spicer winning, owning the libs on Dancing with the Stars?
Except that it's like they use that same thing with Dancing with the Stars, where they you know, use their social media to juice the vote, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm just saying, didn't they use their, it's all driven by social media, Dancing with the Stars.
I'm having a hard time getting into this because I don't watch it. But we had a piece in the Bulwark by Robert Trusinski, who has just done an awful, you know, awesome job. And he says this is what makes this whole Spicer Dance with the Stars episode, he calls it, a perfect microcosm of the Trump era. Okay, I rolled my eyes at that point. Okay, but he goes on. There's the contemptuous dismissal of elites and experts, even experts on dancing. There is the sneering dismissal of anyone who upholds any kind of standards, moral or aesthetic, as quote-unquote clutching their pearls. There is the chest-thumping self-images fighters in a battle against imaginary enemies. In this case, it's the preposterous belief that a ballroom dance show with an over 60 demographic is somehow a secret bastion of the cultural left. People voting for Spicer really think they are owning the libs when they're just annoying the heck out of elderly ballroom fans. By the way, have you ever seen the movie Ballroom Dancing?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay. This is my gift to you. The Baz Luhrmann movie, Ballroom. It is one of the best. It is outstanding. Classic movie.
Did read an article said that Sean Spicer is a terrible, terrible dancer.
Of course he's awful. He's awful. Okay, so let me finish to the last two paragraphs. There's the way how this is a microcosm of the era. There's the way a mob of political obsessives come stomping off of Twitter and recklessly does damage to an institution they know nothing about and don't care about. And finally, right. There is the supreme indifference to actual results in reality, which must be subordinated to the illusion of scoring points in symbolic online fights. I will give Spicer's, this is Robert Trusinski, I will give Spicer's voters credit, though, for accurately capturing the spirit of the moment. A guy who can't dance winning a dance competition is the perfect analogy for the idea that a man who can't govern might win re-election to the presidency.
Yes, agreed.
Oh,
and it is.
Damn.
Yes.
That's good.
No, he's totally right. I mean, it is a terrifying microcosm of how problematic America has become.
And I said we were going to do something light there, but
that's right.
Okay.
You're right.
So,
did you see that green shirt though that he wore the first day? That was amazing.
Okay,
for the flamenco.
I thought it was a Photoshop thing. I really did. It took me a while, but I've been noticing that again and again. The number of things I see, a direct quote from somebody or a picture, and my instinctive reality, because I'm slow, because I'm one of those boomers, is, well, that's Photoshop. That can't be real. And then I realized, no, he wore that.
Can we talk about one of the most important things, because we are on a Bulwark podcast?
Yeah.
Bulwark did a brilliant design today of OK Bloomberg.
Yeah, for my piece, basically telling Michael Bloomberg to go away.
And I think it's time for the Bulwark to start selling merchandise.
Oh,
if you agree, tweet at me.
Tweet
at Charlie.
We have been discussing this. We need to have a whole line of proud to be human scum.
Right.
Something like that. Yeah.
That's right.
Although the OK, as a boomer, see, you're one of these millennials, right? So
yes.
I'm a boomer, and it's like, hey, okay. We can make fun of ourselves, but we don't need the punk kids doing it. Really? Yeah.
Well,
you're going to miss us when we're gone. Really?
You know, woke teenage son, my socialist teenage son, calls me boomer when he gets mad at me. And he's like, okay, boomer. And he says, okay, liberal. These are his put downs. So I now tell him, okay, zoomer. Because
so where did that come? Do you know where it came from? I'm sorry. I'm behind the curve. I confess this.
It's like this whole world of gamers and Chapo Trap House, right? I know nobody knows where it came from. I think it's from the, you know, there are a lot of these. There's a lot of like young 20-something leftists who are really the hostility that I feel towards Trumpism, they feel towards the system as well they should. And the Democratic base is as disillusioned as the Republican base. Just because Democrats don't manifest this in nominating a racist who paints himself orange doesn't mean they are not as angry. And the Democratic base is, I don't know if it's the base or the intellectual, you know, some part of it is very pissed off.
Okay, why are they taking it out on us then? I mean,
I don't know, but I don't know why populist movements tend to do that.
I mean, but the boomers, and of course.
The boomers. They're, because you know why they're taking it out on you?
Yeah.
Because they think, and I actually read something about this, and it's interesting. They think boomers had it much easier than they did. They think that. Every generation thinks that. And so the idea is not that you're a certain age. It's that you had a certain kind of privileged upbringing that the younger generation didn't have or won't have because of the coming climate apocalypse,
do not want to defend the boomer generation. I think, no, I mean, this, please do not make me do this, because we were the most smug generation. I mean, we were, you know, we came after, of course, the greatest generation, you know, that fought and won World War II, survived the Great Depression. But of course, we were the smartest and we were the most conscientious generation. We were so obnoxious. On the other hand, you keep in mind that the boomer generation, you know, see, I'm going to do this. By the end of this podcast, I'm going to be saying the kids need to get off my lawn. I mean, it's just like, okay, hey, guys, you didn't have the freaking draft. You didn't have to go to Vietnam. You didn't have to stop any of those things, you know? your biggest crisis of life is somebody was mean to you on Snapchat. So, I mean, come on. I do not want to defend the boomers. I've spent much of my career making fun of the boomers, except these punks come along. Yeah, you wouldn't have anything without us.
I mean, I would say that I think it's a larger indictment of the upper middle classes and the more comfortable upbringing of the older people.
And so now you Democrats have another 77-year-old billionaire running for president.
He's got his finger on the pulse.
But he's not a boomer, right? I mean, 77 is like pre-boomer, isn't it?
I don't know.
That's too old.
This pains me because I actually really liked him as a mayor. Like, de Blasio, everybody hates de Blasio. Democrats, Republicans, black, white, cops, nurses, everyone hates de Blasio. It's like the sort of the trend. But when you get to someone like Bloomberg, who I actually really liked, like, I love the gun stuff. Like, take away my guns because I've never had one. I know. I hear you. You and Rick can get mad at me later. But So I like all of his message, but I still think he has no possible. There is no world in which he becomes nominated.
So I'm going to tell a story that's going to make you hate me even more. But there's a point because Michael Bloomberg actually created a national phenomenon out of Wisconsin. I share a certain part of the blame here. I am not making excuses here, but it was Michael Bloomberg who back in, what's the year now? Everything drifts, you know, blends together. 2014 or so, he decided that he was going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, taking out the local Milwaukee County sheriff who was a big advocate of guns. Now, up until then, Sheriff David Clark was our problem. He was a local, he was a local figure.
Right.
And had his moments that were okay and had his moments where he was awful. But Michael Bloomberg made him a national figure because he threw all this money in. And then the NRA and the usual trolls and flying monkeys decided that, well, if Bloomberg wants to take out this guy, let's make him a celebrity. And as a result of what Bloomberg did, he elevated David Clark. You know, I'm accused of having helped David Clark, you know, get into office. And I did that, whatever. I will spend time in hell for that. But it was Michael Bloomberg that made him the national figure. And so I watched as this guy becomes more and more famous and goes to his head and he becomes more and more arrogant. And then he gets drawn into the vortex of Trumpism. And then he's on Fox. And then he's getting these awards from the NRA and he's standing with Wayne LaPierre. None of that would have happened if it was not for Michael Bloomberg sitting in his penthouse in New York saying, let's mess with the politics of this state that's somewhere near Minnesota. So this will end in tears is what I'm telling you.
Right. No question. But the only thing I will say about Bloomberg is he's very, very, very smart.
Yeah.
And he tends to spend his money very smartly. So it's not like there are a lot of Democrats, you know, Howard Schultz, I don't think he has any idea what he's doing. The guy with the ties, I mean, whatever. But Bloomberg tends to be smart about how he spends his money. So I have to think that he has some thought here that there's a real path for him because he tends not to do really stupid. I mean, look, all billionaires do really stupid stuff. But it just seems to me like he has to know something we don't. If he doesn't, then I would be really surprised.
You just have too much faith. I think that the phenomenon that we've seen over and over again is that people become billionaires because they have a certain skill set, you know, sometimes in a narrow range of issues. And then they extrapolate from that thinking that because they were able to accomplish A, let's now transfer this to politics, which is not transferable whatsoever. So, and unfortunately, there is this mythos that if, in fact, you are successful at business, you must be successful at everything else in life, which is not true. And Donald Trump is proving that, if you are successful in business, which he was not, you can be successful in government, which is a completely different thing than business. It would be like saying that because so and so is a successful coach in the NFL, you know, let's let them run General Motors. Well, that wouldn't right. transfer. Or because somebody is a really, really good basketball player, let's put them in charge of AT&T, or which is really right. no more crazy than saying that somebody who's made $1 billion because they've sold chips of some kind should be the president of the United States. So I mean, I'm not willing to write that blank check of confidence.
Right. No.
But you're right. He is smarter than Trump. I mean, and richer.
He's smarter and he's richer than a lot of the other guys who've done this. But he's also Jewish, and I just don't see a world in which a Jewish person, as a Jew myself, becomes president. But we will see.
Yeah, I don't think that's his main. I just don't know.
There are like 10 Jews in the world. Like, I mean, I just think Jews in the world. But I mean, I'm just saying there are 3 Jews in this office right now. But largely, it's not a huge group. And I think that could be problematic.
So in Wisconsin, up until a few years ago, we had right. 2 Jewish United States senators, Herb Kohl and Russ Feingold, and it was never an issue. And this is a right. state that is a very active Jewish community in Milwaukee, but not statewide. So you had Russ Feingold and Herb Kohl, and now we actually also now have the first openly lesbian United States senator, and that was never a problem. So it is funny, you know, how you before it happens, you think it can't happen, it's unlikely to happen, right. and then once it does happen, it's like, yeah, that was no big deal, was it?
Well, we had a black president.
That did happen.
You know, and then we went and had an insane president.
And neither one was predictable.
Exactly.
You wouldn't have seen that coming. Molly Jong-Fast, thank you so much for coming in for our special weekend podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you again for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Simply Safe. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.